You are tuned in to KBOO Portland, 90.7 on your FM dial.
Wake up, KBOO listeners. It's time to support local community-based media this fall by donating and becoming a member today. Go to kboo.fm/give. When you contribute now until September 21st, your donations will be matched dollar for dollar, up to $11,000, thanks to listeners like you. Double the impact and double the fun.
Election season is here, and at KBOO, we want Portlanders to be prepared to face their ballots with confidence. We've got a brand new limited series coming to our airwaves and your favorite podcast platform. It's called Running on Air, a daily radio roundtable conversation with the people running to represent Portland. Every weekday, your favorite KBOO host will be facilitating a deeper conversation with these candidates, so tune in. Find the full schedule on our website, kboo.fm/runningonair. Listen to any episodes of Running on Air that you miss on the KBOO website or wherever you get your podcasts. That's kboo.fm/runningonair.
Welcome to the Talking Earth on KBOO Portland for mid-September, almost fall. And this episode has an extra thread of fun because there's a thematic cultural connection among the three readers, which wasn't planned because A, I don't work that way, and B, it's hard enough to get three poets to record for me in the space of a month. But first, I must mention that KBOO's in the midst of our fall fund drive needing to raise $30,000 to pay for operating costs. We are commercial-free, community-driven, free-range, 24/7 radio, which isn't easy work to keep going every day, so we have to pay some people, though never enough, and we have to pay for our power and other utilities. So go to kboo.fm/donate to see how easy it is to donate to KBOO, easier than talking about it. The three featured readers tonight are Leah Stenson, Marilyn Stabline, and C.E. Putnam, who all have lived for years in Asia, different parts. I'll also add in a poem by Roan Shavers. So let's get started with Leah Stenson. Leah is a world traveler, writer, poet, and practicing Buddhist. She is also the author of three poetry books and a hybrid memoir, and co-editor of two poetry anthologies. In the early 1990s, she landed in Portland, where she has since served as managing director of Oregon Peace Institute and on the boards of various arts-related nonprofits. She currently hosts the popular long-running studio series Poetry Reading and Open Mic in South Portland at the Ross Island Cafe. You can find more about Leah at leahstenson.com. Tonight, she'll be sharing some of her insights and understanding of modern Japan.
Good evening, Dan. Thanks so much for giving me an opportunity to read on Talking Earth. I'm honored to be here. As you mentioned, I have a long-term relationship with Japan, which spans over 40 years. So tonight, I'd like to share some of my perceptions of that country with you. I'm going to begin with Tokyo, the floating world adrift, which will give you some insight into the dichotomy I experienced between my expectation of Tokyo and the reality of that mega city when I arrived there in 1978. Tokyo, the floating world adrift. Instead of Asian architecture with antique charm, I found box-like concrete structures built hastily after the war. Ponds with footbridges were still to be found, yet few Japanese had time to sit in a garden, much less admire the moon. Women rushed about in drab business attire, elbowing their way onto the trains like salarymen in their blue pinstripe suits. People flocked to department stores with more fervor than they did to places of worship. The city of my dreams, long gone before I arrived, had quaint tile-roofed houses and gardens with footbridges crossing koi ponds where Basho's moon rippled on the water surface. Women in floral kimono, tightly bound with yards of satin obi encircling their waists, teetered on wooden geta, their hips swaying gently as they minced along cobblestones on the way to Shinto shrines and Buddhist temples. where incense graced the air and people intent on purifying themselves intoned the sutra. In 2011, I was living in Portland when the Fukushima nuclear disaster occurred. My husband and daughter were in Tokyo at the time, and the event impacted me greatly. In response to the disaster, I published an anthology of poetry by Japanese poets entitled Reverberations from Fukushima, 50 Japanese Poets Speak Out, and I'm thankful that readers are still buying that book today. At the time, I went to Japan and toured the nuclear exclusion zone, where I met activist poets who were working to shut down Japan's nuclear reactors. I'd like to read a poem by one of those poets, Masayuki Nomoto. His poem, My Home, Namae Machi, is translated by Keiko Shimada. After I read Nomoto-san's poem, I will read a poem of my own entitled For My Friends in Fukushima, which is dedicated to those brave anti-nuclear warriors. My Home, Namae Machi. When did Fukushima become Fukushima? Fukushima, which is written with Chinese characters meaning Lucky Island, is now written in katakana. I was born and raised in Fukushima in the place called Namae Machi in Futaba County. It used to be a verdant town with the sea and the mountains and two beautiful rivers. Why did I have to flee? Answer me. I liked Namae Machi. I liked it more than anyone. I went fishing when I was a child. I caught birds. I played in the mountains and the rivers. I laid in the fields and watched the floating clouds. Everything was beautiful. People had beautiful hearts. They remained pure even after they had grown up. They had flowers for all four seasons, and people were kind-hearted. My home, Namae Machi. I must come back to this land someday by all means, even if it means hobbling with a cane. I must come back to my home, Namae Machi. And now for my poet friends in Fukushima. In requiems for the dead and prayers for the living, the voices of poets rise and reverberate from the wasteland of Fukushima, defying a silence broken only by the caw of crows and the clanging of metal in the breeze. On the winds of hope, their words arrive on American soil. Like seeds, their truth will be sown in the hearts of people who, in a unified plea, also speak against the nuclear demon that must be vanquished to keep all people safe. So I'm afraid this is getting a little bit heavy, so I'd like to share a more lyrical, lighthearted poem with you now. Hopefully Inokashira Park will be something of a sorbet before my next offering, Tokyo Trains. Inokashira Park, Kichijoji, Tokyo. Circles on the rain-dimpled pond expand, intersect like kimono patterns. Pitter-patter on a plastic umbrella evokes memories of a nursery song Japanese mothers sing to soothe children housebound on rainy days. Pedestrians flow across a footbridge past white swan paddle boats huddled together at the water's edge. I could dwell forever in this yukioe moment, fragment of a floating world. So, Tokyo Trains depicts the situation in Japan of the 1980s. At present, Japan is not quite the workaholic culture it once was, but most of what you hear in this poem still applies. Tokyo Trains. pushed into rush hour trains where windows pop from pressure, impeccably groomed salarymen in white shirts and trench coats read pornographic comics and sex ads while shifting and lurching to the squeal of brakes. They slyly rub up against pert little office ladies in short skirts, hose, and heels who will make copies and serve tea in fluorescent, airless cubicles. After work, these same salarymen will go out and drink until the last train and have to be held as they stumble out the door of the karaoke bar into the dark where they puke their guts out on the train platform, waiting for the Aminote line to take them home to houses the size of rabbit hutches where wives and children wait and pray they won't come home too late or too drunk. Saito-san is out in the rain tonight. It is nearly midnight, but his wife won't let him in. He is calling her name and rapping on the glass door. She, too, is drunk. In her house, there are no slippers in the genkan, no meshi on the table, no hot water in the ofuro, no covers turned down on the futon. In other households, women wait patiently for their samurai salarymen, the kamikaze of Japan's economic miracle. They wait for men who are up too early and home too late to see their children, for men who come home stinking of sake, who, after giving their lives for the company, succumb to karoshi, death from overwork, or even worse, in their retirement, solidify into sodaigomi, oversized pieces of garbage, unwanted nuisances in their own homes. The children fight their way into the trains through bodies packed tightly together as blades of grass. Shouldering heavy leather knapsacks, they struggle to carve out even a small breathing space, barely able to see over the heads of the commuters to the concrete apartments and gray skies of the suburbs, a blur beyond the windows dripping with condensation and sweat. They brave the trains like little Spartans in thin navy uniforms in the dead of winter to attend the best schools, followed by cram schools, until late in the evening. They study to pass safely through the examination hells that will open doors to the best universities and then to the best companies, so they might follow in their father's footsteps. Wives don't ride the trains much. Only after preparing breakfast and making obento for lunch, after cleaning house and hanging laundry, might some adventurous woman take a train to somewhere. Most just bicycle around town, children in the rear, groceries in the front basket, babies on their backs, stopping to gossip on the street with neighbors as they make the ritual rounds to the fruit market, fish market, post office, and bank. They might even drop by a friend's for tea, but they don't want to go too far. They have to be home to wait for the children, to wait for the last train to bring their husbands home. And again, I'm going to change the mood completely and share Blossoming in Sapporo, a personal poem, which I'd like to dedicate to my husband, Bill, who runs a business in Tokyo. Blossoming in Sapporo. After a long cold spell, I was tickled pink when you invited me to view cherry blossoms in Sapporo. Spring came late to the north. Snow still lingered in patches, so we took photos of crows and ate roasted corn instead. At dusk, plastic flowers danced on wires across the street from our hotel, and when we drew close against the night wind, I blossomed. My final offering this evening is a poem I wrote just recently. I've written about suicide in my hybrid memoir, Life Revised. It's been a central theme in my life. That said, I won't be reading about my personal tragedy tonight, but rather about the situation of suicide in Japan, My poem entitled Decorum is haibun, which means there are sections of prose followed by haiku. Decorum. Mourners in black drink tea while the baby cremated. Two by two, wielding chopsticks, they pick out tiny bones from ash, barely enough bones to fill the small urn. No one sheds a tear. Before her altar, the mother offers incense. Rain falls quietly. Japanese mothers understood not to cry on the train platform when sons went off to war to serve as kamikaze. It would have been unpatriotic. Dreaming of my son, hero in a great world war, solace of glory. Descendants of samurai, respected for ritual suicide performed to preserve their honor, salary men who have fallen from grace, perhaps bankruptcy or hard times, hang themselves in forests, or leap onto train tracks in the path of speeding trains to be counted as shinjinjiko, body accidents. My husband is gone now. His blood flows on the train tracks. I pay to clean them. Children bullied by classmates or crushed by the pressure of examination hell are driven to death by suicide, the leading cause of childhood death in Japan, a country with one of the highest child suicide rates in the world. I hide my failure. Hope for the future is gone. I leave like cherry blossoms. Some children opt for living death, lock themselves in their rooms, refusing to come out for years. I feel safe alone, like a half moon in darkness. There is no failure here. Strangers of all ages who connect on the internet choose to die together asphyxiated in sealed cars with lit charcoal braziers. I am not alone. My group travels together to reach the Pure Land. Elderly women interviewed by the filmmaker of Plan 75, a film portraying a fictional plan for state-controlled voluntary suicide for Japanese over 75, said euthanasia would be a welcome way to die, preferable to a slow, painful, or unnoticed death, or worse, the shame of welfare. Better to die now. Better not to die alone. My family agrees. On a Japan Airlines flight to Tokyo, after leaving my lover, a stewardess admonishes me to stop crying. Otherwise, people will think I'm a, quote, bad person. How childish I seem. I act like a foreigner. Decorum is all. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Leah. And yes, it's still KBOO's Fall Pledge Drive, hoping you, KBOO listener, can make a contribution to pay our bills and overwork staff. Just go to kboo.fm/donate. And thanks for being part of the 10%, yes, only 10% of KBOO's listeners who are donating members. Now to our second person who used to live in Asia, now to Marilyn Stablein. She is a multidisciplinary artist working in poetry, prose, performance, and artist books. Her poetry books include Tantric Songlines, A Hybrid Sutra, Milepost 27, she'll be reading from both of those tonight, and Splitting Hard Ground Poems, which won the New Mexico Book Award, the National Federation of Press Women Book Award, and a Southwest Writers Award. Her memoirs include Houseboat on the Ganges and A Room in Kathmandu and Sleeping in Caves. Here's Marilyn.
Compass. This is about Mount St. Helens. Compass. The heart measures without ruler or yardstick, no meter, dial, or glass scope, eyes skyward track, gauge clouds, their formations and shifts. The higher the altitude, the greater the horizon. When the mountain blew itself inside out, distant puffing umbrella cloud plumed 150 miles to the south. Puzzled, I waited Alki's gentle waves. Explosives? Geyser? Reactor? I never saw before or will again a lava dome sculpt the stratosphere. Okay, 56. So the next one is also fiery in the sense of fires, forest fires. Devil's breath. Wind-thrashed firewall sears mile-wide swath down Cobb Mountain. Former riding cabin, a mound of cinders. Surreal ash-powdered stone Buddha, eyes gently shut, sole survivor at Harbin Springs. Unqualified, devastating, worst fire drought on record. Scorching devil's breath, choking black hobobs, obsidian-laden toxic fog clogs cities, clamp windows tight, silence swamp coolers, stay inside, inhale with your mouth shut. Back east, people sandbag homes, blast levees brimming with ornery, reckless floods, curse moisture's incarnations, rain, hail, sleet, snow, while we lust for a few muddled drops. More charcoal this time. Moving into charcoal. Bone black. Early Sanskrit scribes scraped dried soot from oil lamps, charred bones, to make rich coal black inks. Carbon from scorched pine tints my Sumi ink stick. Bison, horses, and great black bulls drawn in charcoal still gallop across Paleolithic cave walls. To think in fire's wake there's something to salvage. After death, my burnt, pulverized bones might tint some artist's palette. Okay, we're going to go from black to blue. Okay, this one is called Blue Alchemy. At the paint store to pick a new color for the kitchen. Something fresh, vibrant. What about blue, I say, remembering cowering glacier and last night's dream. Not turquoise or baby blue. Indigo is too dark, cobalt too heavy. Color chart names leap off the counter, conjuring places, dredging memories. Not the lapis of a lover's gift, idling in jewelry box with broken clasp. No blue veins, hypothermic lips, or bruises. No blue tracks, blood, shoes, or moon. We didn't find Blue Lake, sacred Taos watershed, or Blue Hole's desert oasis. No delicate robin's egg, no ribbons, blue stockings, jeans or collars. How about an ancient oceanic blue, teal, cerulean, or royal blue? Let's cook under Mediterranean blue, I say, the blue of morning mists, Nautilus, Neptune's breath. Our kitchen galley will float like an Aegean ship, mariner, aquamarine, peacock, jay, kingfisher. When I close my eyes, Istanbul's tiled mosque, Vishnu's ghostly tint, and Shiva's blue poison-filled throat. The hardest choice comes last. Earthly heavens, divine blue of a virgin's robe, blue rapture, celestial blue, or just plain wondrous. Okay, now we're going to move to the garden. Compost. Eons before I plotted small 12 by 12 foot veggie patch, lava cinder cone beyond the yard shut down, dried up. Who knows why? Was it abrupt or the tail end of a slow volcanic decline? Doug fir forest now cloaks Rocky Butte. Red cedar needles mulch the south side. My turf lower down is baked ash and clay, back-wrenching to dig, gritty, stubborn. I save the juiciest kitchen scraps, fruits and veggies to compost, make arable what is hard scrabble. With pitchfork I fold apple cores, pears, beets, potato skins into the heap, glistening oval papaya seeds, bruised bananas, hairy kiwi rinds, even a salmon's silvery scales to bury deep, till, mulch, water. Summer, crookneck squash leaves wide as elephant ears, canopy dark humus soil, four healthy volunteer tomato plants sprouted, thrive even in that gentle shade, sun-flushed fruit heavy on the vine. So I'm going to move to my new book, Tantric Songlines, a Hybrid Sutra. I'm just going to read a little sort of it's like a colophon in the back. Kind of sets the situates the poem in my history. Tantric Songlines, a Hybrid Sutra, is derived from an ongoing series of poetic spoken, chanted, written, and visual narratives that document and celebrate a seven-year sojourn in and around the Himalayas to honor cultural, historical, ritual, geographical, environmental, and time and place-based encounters with people, animals, habitats, myths, and spirits who populate those off-the-grid ancient pilgrimage trails, sites, and landmarks. So this book was published by Shivistan Press in Woodstock, New York, and it's sort of a distillation of, I used to do a lot of performances when I lived in the Hudson Valley in upstate New York. I had a band called Bardo Motel. It had two musicians and a dancer who was a Kentucky Indian. She was American, but she had studied this type of dance where you barefoot, where you do the percussion with your feet and twirl in these costumes. And it was a lot of fun. We had gigs in the different venues around Kingston and Woodstock and New Paltz. So there are 11 sections, and I'm going to read about three or four. And I'll start with, from section three. Months pass, spring in the Deer Park at Sarnath, monsoon on a pine-forested ridge in Almora, winters near the bustling and chaotic holy meccas of Kashi and Dorje Den, summers on the Darjeeling Ridge, across the valley Sandak Fu, a 12,000-foot peak, snow crystals glisten, sparkle. At sunrise, Ice twinkles, shimmers in the light of a full moon. I bathe in rivers, lakes, and ponds, and once under a faucet in a public square, wearing a sari. I chase monkeys that invade my room, watch the Maharaja's elephant graze on Bodhi tree branches outside my window, which had no glass, just bars, so you could hear the munching of the Bodhi tree branches. In Orissa, curious dung beetles work the sandy dunes near cashew forests on the Bay of Bengal. In Nepal, where wild irises grow among rhododendron forests, leeches suck my blood. I pick wild strawberries and immense blooms from hibiscus trees and graze on wild ferns, miner's lettuce, and tree leaves boiled into sog. Spinach. Okay, the next one. So this will be section 2 about food, some food. Morning ritual, ginger omelet, whole wheat chapatis, yogurt, lentils, the ubiquitous hot chai with steaming hot water buffalo milk. In the Himalayas, I pick wild saffron from the fragile wild crocus to flavor a pot of rice with saffron. In Orissa, on the Bay of Bengal, village women teach me how to forage for 5 kinds of wild plants, leaves from hedges and trees, flowers, bulbs, and roots. Food is scarce in Orissa. People eat rice 3 times a day. I learned to cook rice in many different ways. Rice with cane sugar, milk rice, boiled rice, fried rice, rice patties, rice cakes, rice bread, rice custard, flattened rice with tea, puffed rice with curry powder, popped rice, and rice noodles. After 1 month, I crave anything but rice. Fishermen bring me a stingray entangled in a net. Please, you take this ugly devil of a fish, one said. I'll give it a try to flavor my rice. I hack the rubbery stingray into chunks with a dull knife. I hack, rip, tear, and saw for an hour, and then simmer the fish for 2 hours in a pot on a cow dung fire. Still, the flesh is too chewy to swallow. So I go back to eating boiled rice, fried rice, milk rice, rice patties, rice cake, rice bread, rice custard, popped rice, rice noodles, rice porridge, flattened rice with milk, and rice gruel. Okay, this one is 21. This is section 10. My name changes. To the Nepalese, I am Didi, sister, or Ani, nun. To the Tibetans, I am Lamo Seki. In their fashion of giving spiritual names, I am God, woman, life happy, or goddess of happy life. To my Muslim tailor, I am Pumo Zukbo Ringbo, the long, tall woman who needs extra cloth for her long skirts. To the Tibetan abbot, who invites me to paint a fresco on his new temple wall, I'm honored by La Tripa, the god painter. So I will close with the last part, which is 11. Some nights I sway and reel, intoxicated by the ethereal tunes of sitars, tablas, Indian vocalists, and glittery costume dancers who celebrate through the night in tented concerts that end only after Surya rides his sun chariot into a morning sky. I read the texts in the languages they are written in. I know by heart the names, faces, and hymns of deities I paint on temple walls. I know the geographies of rivers, ponds, and streams, the routes of trains, the maps of bazaars, the itineraries of pilgrims, song lines tattooed on the skin of my heart.
Thanks, Marilyn. Our pledge drive ends this week. Not that we won't take money any day, but please help us meet our $30,000 goal. Before the third and final feature poet, here's the first poem, the first chronica in Roan Shaver's book, Ten Chronicas. On the Form. The work of art, like the world, is a living form. It is. It has no need of justification. The same is true of a symphony, a painting, a novel. It is in their form that their reality resides. Alain Robrelet. There is an image of a window in the window, and in that window there is a window, and in that window there is an image. Look closely enough at this image and you'll find a hole. And down that hole is the one thing we swore would hide away forever, the thing we swore would bury because it hurt to have it seared into memory. And now we never speak of it, except perhaps in passing when we mention only that one particular window always in need of repair. What is it with Americans and their obsession with apertures? Is it a fear of doors closing, opportunities or possibilities lost, or is it something else entirely? Could it be something as simple as a form of mass hysteria, however tiny, that when opportunity presents itself, what will happen is that they'll be vulnerable, exposed for what they really are, lost, small, and each one alone? So once it becomes obvious that her successes would so completely dwarf my own and would always continue to do so, all I felt, all I could say was, no, I'm not afraid of dying. It's the living that worries me more. After all, who in their right mind fears death when the alternative is the absence of a presence? This mania for coherence, for matter and mattering, when we're just grains of animated stardust. After all, wouldn't it be better to know ourselves by discovering everything that we're not? After all, we're neither absent or present, just traces of what we used to be. And yet who can forget that infamous moment recorded for all posterity when Victor Hugo accused Marie-Henri Boyle of an intellectual style reflective of nothing but aphorisms and epigrams, to which Boyle replied, au contraire, for wasn't it Stendhal who said, we didn't stop. We didn't stop because there was something ecstatic in the leaving, a scent of the secret breath of life that tells you to keep moving, and so we did. In moving, it was as if our daughter was still with us, all giggles and elbows instead of a bloody handprint on hood of a Nissan Sentra. Yeah, I did the corporate thing for a while, but only until I found my calling. Nowadays, I run a 100% organic, locally sourced, artisanal, very small batch, semen farm. I'm a bit low on stock right now, but stay in touch, and I'm sure I can arrange a free sample for you. If you want, maybe even hand-delivered. To think of it as documentation is to mistake the sign of the thing for the thing itself. Thus, on the 12th day, it occurred to her that what she really could not be represented, only captured or recreated. Essentially, representation was the representing of a stylistic artifice, meant to completely supplant the presentation of an artifact, and so it was necessary to begin anew. The form became the art, inasmuch as the art contained the idea of art itself, the surface as its own eternal synecdoche, the part that stands in for the whole. To ask what is a chronica is similar to asking what is form. A chronica is both ligament and foundation, that which simultaneously connects and exposes the fissures between connections. In short, the chronica is not so much a transcription as it is a construction, the language of true cohesion. Fuck it. It's Friday. Let's get lit. John Barth. And that was Roan Shavers. And now C.E. Putnam. His seventh book, The Bird May Be Dead, But It Is Your Bird, will be published in 4 days, and he's reading from it now. His other books include XX Elegies, a broken lyric revisioning of John Donne, Maniac Box, 27 film treatments. He has previously served as curator and presenter for the Subtext Reading Series in Seattle and DC Poetry at the DCAD Art Center in Washington, D.C. He is the founder of the Putnam Institute for Space Opera Research, PISOR. His sound works include PISOR Scares, a series of mind-melting Halloween-themed sound collages. No sound collage, just the voice. See Putnam.
Good evening, everyone. I'm C.E. Putnam, and tonight I'll be reading from my brand new book, The Bird May Be Dead, But It Is Your Bird. Majority of the poems in the book were written between 2014 and 2020, after I returned to the Pacific Northwest after years spent in Southeast Asia. The book is in three sections, and I'll be reading a few poems from each. Enjoy yourself. Section 1. The relation between you and you makes you. The whole day today, floating in a kidney-shaped swimming pool, algae plumed and starred with coy polished stones. First, a bar of cloud. Warm long grasses in the distance churned up my Arctic stomach breezes. Then, floating on my back, I counted the leaves of an enormous fan palm waving all confounding blue vulgar shadows and watched silken pigeon droppings coo and wink their way down to the pink tiled bottom. A caretaker frightened away a gang of dive-bombing crows with an empty blue water cooler bottle. Blue plastic black feather loop smacking loop. Later, I pleased my imagination with the idea of the first circle. A rusted ring without center, under which I always find another wider, darker one. Opening wrecked without beginning or end, and thinking I will never, ever, ever forget their order, until I lost leaf count and had to start over, alive and stupid with wonder. Winding River, a part I could not borrow. Drop of water to drop of water, dragonfly leisure and vagabond buzz debt barging up river and down. 30 more years wearing flowered shirts, conversing with the bodies they want. Add temporary works, a knot of roots under a parking lot, an egret in its egg, wondering what its wings are for. But who is going to purchase that? Subtract phase rewards. We must write all our animals now. I revolve in the gravity of spirits, above the sea electric, with Napoleon below on that prison island, beating the air, flightless and stupid. Red cranes spoil the beaches, and then my isolation feels so mechanical. I am following a single water bug's total circuit from truck bed, 10 packs, to pink funnel, to yellow work boots. Lizards in the stairwell, ants in the walls. There is a deep, deep distance. I feel it out there, an internal ocean tidying up beyond any horizon. I need to see our planet in the water, the white flower, does not stop going down. The everlasting noodle is its own delight. It is not just a feeling of corruption without profit, without you, outside the city walls, inside the city walls, then some noodles taking off shoes in our tiny days, bowling on red carpet. My dear fish balls, someone is howling 3 times along with the cardboard pile in the stairwell. 3 times the spicy broth with peanuts is over there. Look away. 3 times not many happy days filled to the brim. Bean sprouts on top. Remember when we took ourselves off into the moonlit hangar, and we're floating so high up and beyond all stars. We might as well have that as our tender keepsake, falling away. Goodness will be decreasing while evil increases. I remember the field by the Red Lantern Cellar as it was before the Red Lantern Cellar ever was, and for a moment might imagine the way suffering can be both your body and a nest. Now, a fire engulfs the field, and I study the way a broken bird emerges from the loosened earth and beaks a horrid path in struggle to get to light, to be, as amazing as it may seem, a pale blue egg again in the afternoon sun. Maybe after 2,112 transformations, I will also be flattened, glowing, polished silver, friend of all the universe. Friend to all I see. Plain wilderness. Western mountain snowfall or ashfall, every city has three weather garrisons buttressing against the ice storm. Citizens gather on Goon River's midnight ice clear, watching frozen drone pigeons fall from the bridge, roped off, drunk, and starlit. Inside the shortwave, Everly brothers separate Tanya's tears one by one, saving the dark sick ones to cross the horse out. Without you, I had to endure that song, unbearable personal day depression, all by my lonesome, all by myself. Section 2. The infinity of the heavenly seas. The tabernacle shape of our nice universe. The dead waters were above it. The dying waters were below. That it is of the earth, that the water should not be like that, that orca blowhole gorged and clogged with waste, to sail dreaded upon it, in a state of vapor, to never bring the world back to its starting point in the same limit of time. Desk-bound trees. I won't forget, and you should remember too, that this is me doing the best that I can, interplanetary. Oh, I know, interplanetary. Oh, yes, I know, interplanetary, interplanetary. The earth, what have you, remains fixed, a zenith marked, but planets can orbit on their own. Outside me, our child, the moon, our fire, the sun, and probably everything else, all wasted or worse, under smoked glass. This is not an ending, how you break the day that is every day from now on, or just fuck that for a little while. This graveyard geology, springtime haze, green maple leaves, and finally coming around to appreciating the planet Venus, because it gives us another world that we cannot live on, that is not Earth. Outside Patterson. Tell me about your fourth dream. Pink dawn hitchhiking. I'm in a pickup and I'm going to see the doctor for an annual physical with Jack Nicholson, and he is driving. He's got belly rolls of filet mignon sickos guzzling spitbug moonshine foam from a jar. We had never seen each other before. He says he saw a vision of himself reborn in a hell world, holding a clear monkey cigar, surrounded by nurses and manatees on fire, and came out of that inferno with an incredible lack of self-esteem.
Germs, germs, he says, are germs wherever they go. Glazed onto the dashboard, dark and heavy, lacking dankness and of modest green, a barely satisfactory huff of reefer from the heating vent, whirring hogs between crustaceans. But wait, what's in this stuff? Paralyzed chickens, hospital cinders, a gupping fish maw. Flossie opening her nightgown for a locust tree, a red petal edge of sky. I want to be in a separate examination room and away from this drug-enforced intimacy. His hand now is always somewhere on or near my body. But since my parents are dead, I could never get another brother. There's not any other good doctor within 154 miles. Section 3. Fishy Action. Living free in the wild, little fish, all denizens of the deep, bearers of spiritual light, current the darkness where the sun cannot reach. All creatures scaly and bare, even the one-eyed fish, scuttle and scrape among the dazzle rocks. We must always remember there are some who, by a peculiar twist of mind, seem incapable of appreciating gills and suckers and fins and the many amazing facets of fishy action. Fishy action. They would be so shocked and delighted when they finally learn what fishy action could do for them. Fishy action. And from then on, they never really let up talking about it. Never call them seagulls. The Gandalf fishes feed me their eggs. Soft and smooth muscles cringe and shock the body, growing ovals under the skin. The wink-busted skulls creak spring crows over the stubble field's makeshift meadow, everything now perfectly destitute. Radish-crammed gills, chain links jagged and torn. How'd I get to be so biologically illiterate as to not feel these colorless birds grow scarce and disappear? Why not just kill all of creation? A return to the moss garden in the forest, snapping kelp more than I can bear the foot of a diving duck frozen in the ditch. You cannot fall on the pen and die, can you? The fish boat has arrived. Shell the noise through the dirty shell. This world will be a night oyster we can call our own. Broken stems on rotten logs. One slip, be buried. All manner of flies are zooming about. Isthmus. The green sunrise told me the table closest was the danger. Courtyard teetering, snack shack closed, a dark ring pattern. The sign of the starfish, the hands of a dancer turning from orange to black in the fire. At first, with some shock, the horse returned from the whirlwind. Why do you call that noise a jubilee? Saffron grasses, sustains breath, moss brawl, the bruised ball bearings. I was still growing, tried on hooves, my abandoned feeling, and took it even deeper inside. Prune clothes in tatters, a dark inertia, couldn't get up, but felt exhilarated. Across empty headlands, grit clings to me as if it were the entire history of grit. Closed face eyelids in the wind, the stinging tentacles of the jellyfish, the fighting ocean growled. It does not like me. The growl became more and more noticeable. I don't know. A rolling foam, fish rush into it, play locks, the spiral sand belt stars around your waist for about 5 minutes, and then nothing at all. Canyon Green. Cool mountain caterpillar retreat. Bored by all this pupa action. Sad, my cricket children, dumb wingless beasts. The moon floats away, turnips, then radishes, consecrate to death flies this swatter empty-handed bright red blood pepper pod of a single vine, all death-popping shiny mingling with snails in my newly thatched, a bush murmuring petals. Frog interior hollow, open your mouth. The evening bell, green-orange in my garden, a lovely sunset, fails by its own will. November uncertain. Stupid storks. Thanks for listening, everyone. Here's my last poem for the night. It's called Moon Radish. If you can hold a moon radish in your hand without looking at it, you will be able to penetrate the subconscious of your moon body. Automatically, as you interact with this change inside you, you will recognize it first as a white light, then emotion light, provocative light, spiritual light, or depth of psychomotor light, and so on. You will probably want to recreate this orbiting body state again and again, as I have, coming to understand only later how this feeling is the thing we have no choice in, as we sit in the grass watching the field hoppers jump into the sunset, but to believe in consciousnesses between the subconsciousnesses is to take the whole of the action of holding, of burning, to change its sense without looking, to charge it up, to bring in more colors in order to make the spell ring out, becoming an enormous gong, gonging, gonging at the edge of a darkening forest. Now you can hear what I've been longing to see.
Yeah, you can hear CE Live October 15th at the 13th Moon Gravity Well, 41st and Holgate, with Casey Bush, who also has a new book out, Notes and Motes, and will be hosted by me, Dan Raphael, reading from an old book of mine. Let's work in a poem or two from local poet James Eyrie. The book is titled S/2004N1, Dummy Pool. Orbiter, space-time adjusts to conform to prevailing political paradigm. In this universe, Beethoven lacked patience. You can't blow through a wall of frozen ammonia with a canoe. The pudding takes our taste, our tongues, and leaves us hanging there in the light and dust of our bodies, our reacting, from which time is distilled, what I remember as symptomatology of errors originating before the recombination. They like to think they remember, sometimes confusing King and Hawking, but ever have you seen them in the same room? Light wear to the edge of the earth? Hell's fine. James Eyrie. Yeah, always good to end these shows with thanks. So much to be thankful for. Thanks, of course, to the three featured poets, C.E., Marilyn, and Leah. Thanks to all of you for listening. Thanks to all of you who contribute to KABU. Thanks to all the bookstores and performance venues that support poets. Thanks to all those who organize readings, have small presses and zines on the internet. Thanks to those who read books of poems. Just reading books, that's good right there. Thanks to the founders and longtime hosts of The Talking Earth, Walt Curtis and Barbara Lamorticella. Thanks to The Other Side of The Talking Earth, second Monday of every month, Patrick Bocard. And, it's soon fall. A couple more days left to KABU's pledge drive. And more importantly, get registered to vote if you're not, and study what's going on and vote. It's real important that a certain repeat offender doesn't get to be a repeat president. The whole city council thing happening here in Portland is going to be real interesting. Ranked choice voting. Let's have it be more choice than rank and get some good representation. I mean, if there can be good government, maybe this is one way to do it. But this is Dan Raphael wishing you all a good night, good day, whenever, wherever you are, and keep the poetry rolling.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Hey, KBOO listeners, you want to tune in to PDX Progressive Talk Radio every fourth Wednesday at 7 p.m.